Fourth case this morning, which is U.S. versus Hines.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Daniel Hillis, and I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Hines. He has raised three issues on appeal. First, there's the matter of the two-level enhancement. The two-level enhancement was applied for the counterfeit access device, and the district court determined that the enhancement applied because Mr. Hines had trafficked in a counterfeit access device. But simple use of a counterfeit access device doesn't warrant the enhancement, and the district court found that by obtaining control over the counterfeit access device, that was the reason that the enhancement should apply, and that determination is incorrect. Simply obtaining the counterfeit access device is insufficient. To engage in trafficking, there must be proof and a finding that a defendant obtained control with intent to transfer or dispose of the counterfeit access device. There was no such finding in this case. There was never any proof that Mr. Hines intended to transfer or dispose of the counterfeit access device that he used. Therefore, for that reason alone, the trafficking enhancement is improperly applied in this case, and it warrants
Something about finding some things in the toilet? What was he doing with that?
There were cards as well that were found. And again, there's no dispute that he had cards and he used cards. But did he intend to transfer or dispose of those, give those to other individuals to be used, such that the trafficking requirement could be established? And that didn't happen. There was no finding on that in any event, Judge. There had to be a finding, at the very least, in addition to proof, and there was neither in this case. So for those reasons, the trafficking enhancement cannot be properly applied here. The district court did not make any finding on production, and the government's brief devotes itself to a determination, or rather an argument, about production. But that's not the basis the enhancement was applied. And therefore, I don't think the court should get into that. But to the extent that the court wishes to hear argument on that matter, I'd state as follows. There was had to be, with respect to the production, evidence of who produced the cards. And the testimony by the case agent, and I believe this is at Appendix 6 in the defendant's brief, is that the case agent didn't know who produced the cards at issue. So there's never any proof of production. I believe that's actually when the district court went and conferred with the probation officer and came back and made the alternative finding, rather the exclusive finding, that instead of production, we'll rely on the trafficking enhancement to impose the 2B2.1B11B1 enhancement. In any event, the record evidence in this case was that the district court imposed the enhancement based on trafficking without making a finding of fact to support the enhancement, and then there was no finding on production.
Whose names were on the cards?
They were variously embossed with the names of the individuals who were participating in the offense. Mr. Hines' name was on some of the cards, a very small portion of the cards, but in any event, that goes to his use, not to his intent to transfer. That would support the trafficking enhancement again. And again, there was no finding or no enhancement based on production. Unless the court has further questions on that matter, I'd like to go to the second issue in the brief. And the second issue on appeal is a challenge to the supervised release conditions that allow for the suspicionless searches and require Mr. Hines to pay for drug treatment and testing. Even upon conviction, Mr. Hines is protected by the Fourth Amendment. The district court had no authority to order Mr. Hines to submit to suspicionless searches and seizures by law enforcement. So I believe that condition is inappropriate. Also, as to the payment, at the very least, the condition is improper because it does not explicitly state, per this court's recent decisions in United States versus Baker and United States versus Siegel, that Mr. Hines cannot be re-imprisoned if he is unable to pay. And the court's pronouncements in those cases consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Bearden versus Georgia. For that reason alone, that condition is improper. and it should be remanded to the district court. Mr. Hines also contends that the district court lacks statutory authority to impose a payment requirement. And I'll stand on what I said in the briefs. And if the court has additional questions on this matter, I'd be happy to answer them. But there's no statutory authority that allows the district court to impose a payment requirement. The district court can merely...
he doesn't need a statutory... She doesn't need a statutory basis. She can do it on her own. But there may be other reasons that she has to indicate why.
Very true, Your Honor. In 3583D1-3, and then the catch-all provision would have a series of requirements and findings that must be made, and those weren't made here. And for that reason, the payment condition would be inappropriate. But I would submit that even if those findings were made, for the district court to impose an indigent defendant a court-ordered obligation to make a payment for treatment and testing that individual may not need or especially benefit from, that is problematic. That would implicate his property rights, and I think that would warrant additional scrutiny. But in any event, Your Honor is correct. The findings were not made under 3583D, and therefore the condition would be improper. And that leads me to the third argument. That is, even if the district court could have imposed the challenge conditions, it could do so only if it made the requisite 3583D findings. The district court made no findings for either of the two challenge conditions in this case. Therefore, under United States versus Goodwin, the lack of findings should cause this court to vacate the conditions. With a particular view towards the suspicionless search condition, this court has decided United States versus Farmer. That was a condition where a suspicionless search was imposed by the same judge, and it was identical condition, and it was vacated because the necessary findings weren't made. So under Farmer, at the very least, the suspicionless search should be vacated so the district court that wishes to entertain the prospect can make the necessary 3583D findings. Consistent with his arguments and the authority cited in his briefs, Mr. Hines would respectfully ask this court to give him the relief that he requests, and I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Schellenberger.
May it please the court. Court, my name is Todd Schellenberger. I'm an assistant United States attorney for the Southern District of Indiana. I represent the United States in this appeal. Trevor Hines pled guilty to conspiring to use counterfeit access devices and conspiring to commit bank fraud through the use of counterfeit access devices. And as an overt act of that conspiracy, he conceded in a written stipulation that he and the other co-conspirators first obtained 300 counterfeit access devices embossed with their names. After obtaining these counterfeit access devices, as Hines stipulated, the group then traveled from New York to Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Ohio, and southern Indiana and used these counterfeit access devices to obtain valuable merchandise from wholesale and retail merchants in the four states. When he was intercepted in the Southern District of Indiana, the vehicle that was being used by the group and a bathroom near the vehicle were searched, and 304 counterfeit access devices, being both counterfeit credit cards and counterfeit debit cards, were recovered. Those cards were embossed with the names of the participants in the conspiracy charged in the indictment. That is, their names are actually imprinted in the plastic of the specific cards. And when examined, the magnetic stripe on the back of the cards were found to have been encoded with account numbers of innocent persons whose account numbers had been compromised. This evidence presented to the district court through the testimony of the case agent at the change of plea hearing and through the written stipulation agreed to by Mr. Hines and signed by Mr. Hines gave the district court a substantial amount of evidence to make a conclusion that the offense involved the production and or trafficking in counterfeit access devices.
If I could draw your attention, at least this is in the appellant's brief, the sentencing, I assume it's the sentencing. Anyway, the judge's page, appellant's, Appendix 7 of the appellant's brief, it talks about exactly where you're at. Is that what you're relying on, the court believes that the trafficking definition applies in this matter?
Your Honor, the government believes that the discussion in the sentencing hearing that was engaged in by the parties was focused almost completely on the trafficking prong of the guideline provision. But that was a result of the oral arguments that were occurring on that issue. It's the government's position that the entire record allows for the court to make that finding, not only on the trafficking but also on the production, and that there was ample evidence in the record with respect to production and with respect to trafficking. But the court, in looking up the definition of trafficking and addressing that specifically, was responding to the precise argument that was being made by defense counsel at the time. And I don't believe it's fair to conclude that it was that the decision by the district court was made only based on trafficking and only on the one point that she made in looking up the definition and responding to the argument that was being made. Mr. Hines relies on primarily on one case to support his position that the enhancement should not have been applied, an Eighth Circuit case, the Salem case. And that case is significantly different from the circumstances presented by this case to this court, based on the nature of the offense involved in the conviction and based on the type of access devices involved. In the Salem case, the defendant pled guilty to one substantive count of using a counterfeit access device, not a conspiracy. And the government's position is that in a conspiracy case, Mr. Hines is responsible for all acts of co-conspirators that are reasonably foreseeable, including those acts of individuals made in preparation for the commission of the offense, and that would include the preparation and production of these counterfeit access devices. And he
even
had
though he wasn't in a conspiracy when it was mailed, but he was.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He was in participated in preparation for carrying out the end result.
I think that the record clearly shows that he had to have been a participant to some degree because his actual name is imprinted on these cards, and the conspirators, at the very least, if they did not produce the cards themselves, had to provide their names to the producer so that they can be embossed on the cards and facilitate their use. In addition, the type of access device involved in the Salem case was a UPC code that was basically transferred from a lower-priced product onto a higher-priced product so that when it passed through the scanner at the Walmart store, it would record a lower price. And that type of access device could simply have been stolen or removed from one item and put on another. These access devices required much greater degree of preparation. They had to have the names placed on them, embossed on them, and they also had to have the compromised account numbers encoded into the magnetic strip. So it was a much higher degree of production that had to have occurred in this case when compared to Salem. Hines also challenges the imposition of a special condition of supervised release requiring the defendant to pay for a portion of the cost of drug treatment. We think that the record available to this court would allow this court to determine that the defendant has waived any right to appeal that issue. And we would point to the record and the parts of the record that show how completely engaged defense counsel was at sentencing with respect to the issues related to drug treatment and drug abuse on the part of his client. Even though the condition was not announced prior to the hearing that it was being considered, the district court made it clear that it was announcing its attendant sentence and the parties could interject at any point. And indeed, the defense counsel did that specifically with respect to the drug treatment conditions. He did not object to the condition requiring partial payment, and he, in fact, asked the court to impose an additional condition with respect to drug treatment that the court recommended he receive drug treatment while in the Department of Corrections. The court accepted that recommendation and made it a part of her sentence.
Defendant only filed the supplemental information with regard to a case that we issued, U.S. versus Siegel. How does that?
Your Honor, of course, the Siegel case is important, and this court took the opportunity in the Siegel case to make a set of recommendations on best practices as to how to impose supervised special conditions of supervised release in the future, and that case was decided.
I'm more interested in the cost related to
it. Your Honor, the court in Siegel did not specifically delve into the standards of review that it was using in order to remand the Siegel case. But I think with respect to this case that the court can find that waiver occurred or that the court or that the special condition involving a requirement to pay a portion of the costs can pass a plain error review because, as the government has cited in its brief, the district court does have authority to impose this condition under 18 U.S.C. section 3672.
Well, again, I'm more concerned not the fact that you impose the drug rehabilitation thing, but the fact that he's required to pay for it.
Yes, Your Honor. And
in the Siegel, revoking defendant's supervised release and recommitting him to prison for a mere inability to pay would constitute imprisonment for debt.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the government understands that Siegel certainly has implications in this case. We point out that it wasn't decided based on an application, based on a waiver analysis or a plain error analysis, and that in this case we know that the defense counsel was very aware of the drug conditions, was very engaged on those, did not object, and in fact recommended an additional condition. If the court does believe that the remand is necessary based on Siegel and based on the Johnson case that the government also cited in its supplemental authority letter, then we would ask the court to remand only with respect to requiring the district court to add a condition that the payment special condition be limited to circumstances when the defendant has the ability
to
pay.
That's what happened in Siegel.
Yes, Your Honor, but not a remand that would prohibit a partial payment.
As to payment.
Yeah, it would not prohibit partial payment on the part of the
defendant. Prohibit, but she made findings here that he didn't have any money anyway, though, didn't she, earlier? Or had very little?
The pre-sentence report certainly reflected he had minimal means, of course, and he had appointed counsel. But, of course, the district court's in a difficult position of having to make conditions set out for the future, and it's hard to anticipate what circumstances might change. Your Honor, the government also cited in its supplemental authority letter with the court on September 3rd, the Farmer decision, and the government concedes that the search condition imposed in this case is the same as the condition that was imposed in Farmer. Was imposed under the same condition procedures, and it can't be distinguished. And for that reason, we concede that the court must remand for a revision of the search condition that is consistent with the Farmer decision. So we'd ask the court to affirm the sentence of imprisonment as it is based on a correct application of the sentencing guidelines. We'd ask the court to find that Hines has waived further any objection to the drug conditions based on his engagement on that specific issue at the sentencing hearing, or that the court did not plainly err in imposing that condition. But if the court finds that the Siegel and Johnson cases require a remand for that, we'd ask that the remand be limited only to directing that the costs be paid only if the defendant has the ability to pay. And finally, we concede that the search condition must be vacated and remanded for modification consistent with the Farmer decision. If the court has no further questions, I'd sit down.
Thank you, counsel.
Would you be satisfied with a remand?
I would be curious to know what that would entail, Your Honor. Would it be a remand with any orders that the payment condition not be imposed, striking the suspicionless search with an order
to give reasons?
Beg your pardon?
Or to give reasons?
To give reasons, absolutely. What is this court to review without reasons? And that brings
Well, we went for a long time without doing that, back when Judge Bauer and I both sentenced without the sentencing guidelines.
I think the progress is good here, Your Honor, and I hope that it's to be continued. And so I'm going to begin in that vein. There was no finding on production. There should be findings. If this court wants to review an adequate record where there's a production enhancement, make findings. That didn't happen here. And the court can review the record and make its own mind on whether or not the district court engaged in an alternate disposition. It did not. It imposed the enhancement based on trafficking. The case that we cited, Salem, said that you have to have production in order for the enhancement to apply. There's testimony by the case agent. They don't know who produced the fraudulent access, counterfeit access devices in this case. That's why they went to an alternate basis. But that alternate basis wasn't sufficient either. There's no waiver of the payment requirement here. My client asked for drug treatment, and that's to his credit. He didn't ask that he be made to pay for the service that would be rendered, and there's no notice of the condition in advance of the hearing. And so to find that there would be a waiver, a knowing relinquishment of a known right, a payment
obligation. I wouldn't belabor the point if I were you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Move forward in that case.
And the last one, they've already conceded.
Well, other than to make this point, Your Honor, not to belabor the point, I'm mindful of that, but 18 U.S.C. allows to recoup costs, not to impose them on a forward-going basis. And if the government wants somebody to pay for something because they don't know what he's going to have in the future by way of resources, there's a mechanism for that. 18 U.S.C. 3582C allows for a modification procedure. Instead of cluttering this court's docket with appeal upon appeal of conditions, supervised release, the government may be well advised to quit seeking numerous conditions and impose, modify as necessary based on a record that is later presented that warrants the conditions imposition, instead of thinking too far ahead and cluttering the record with appeal upon appeal for conditions that may never take effect or be unnecessary. Unless the court has questions of me, I have nothing further.
And you're satisfied with their concession with regard to the warrantless search, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That strikes the condition. And if there needs to be something else on that and there's an additional appeal, we'll take that as it comes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.